Now, we left off last time. We have chapter 4 is a little different. It is written in the first person, and the speaker is Nebuchadnezzar himself. He talks of his humbling experience and recognizing that the Lord rules in heaven. We have in chapter 5 events that take place between 25 and 30 years after. And so quite a lull of time. Let's briefly go over a few things. We mentioned before that Nebuchadnezzar is basically synonymous with the Chaldean Empire and Babylon. That you are dealing with a very, very capable man. He is his father was king when he was out with the armies and conquering the western half of the empire. While he was in the middle of that, his father passed away. He runs back to Babylon for the coronation and resumes his conquest. And he rules for 43 years altogether. And he built Babylon into the great city it was. It was a very, very old city when he came along, but he is the one who made it the greatest it ever was. He passes off the scene. His son comes to the throne. His son rules for 2 years and is bumped off by his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law, by the way, is one of the military commanders that was there at the conquest of Jerusalem. He's the same guy that turned Jeremiah loose after it was all over. He rules for 7 or 8 years and then dies a natural death. His son comes to the throne and is almost immediately bumped off. And we have a guy named Nabonidus coming to the throne. Now, Nabonidus is important, but he's not recorded in the scripture, not mentioned there. And one of the reasons that this is important is we have several different records of ancient Near Eastern history. We have something called the Nabonidus Chronicle. We have two different Greek historians, and I'm going to put these guys' names up here. There's all different kinds of ways to pronounce them. I say Xenophon and Herodotus, but they're pronounced different ways, different people. This is going to come back in next week. So the two Greek historians are important. We have Xenophon. You like that name? Isn't that great? Xenophon. Ooh, I like that. That's good. And then Aaron, help me. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Now, those two fellows didn't write very far apart from each other. They it's possible they even knew each other. There's a big enough window that they could know each other. For a lot of what they have written, Xenophon and Herodotus, they're in agreement. But there's some big sections that are irreconcilable. And the irreconcilable thing is the thing we're going to be talking about next week. But I put these guys' names up here just to have that in the back of your mind. Because none of these historians, Nabonidus Chronicle, Xenophon, Herodotus, nobody mentions Belshazzar, who is the first word there in chapter 5. And if you dared to do that, I don't do this, I don't recommend you do it. There's nothing profitable in scrounging through this other than to discredit them. If you were to go back to commentaries written in the late 19th century by unbelievers, and there were a lot of them, you'd be surprised. These guys were all trying to make a mark for themselves as they scoffed at the scriptures. One of their targets was Daniel. And one of the reasons there was a target of Daniel is we have this fella named Belshazzar in chapter 5. And he's not here, and he's not here, and therefore he wasn't. That was their conclusion. We have a king listed in Daniel. Now, which is, to me, you would think that a guy named Daniel who was living there, knew the guy, would know whether or not he was there or not. And the historians that came 200 years later would have probably a lesser idea of the likelihood of whether or not a guy actually exists or not. But so be it. And by the way, these two guys did not say there was no Belshazzar. It's just that Belshazzar's not listed in a succession of kings. And we'll come to the reason as to why that's the case. I mentioned Nabonidus came to the throne. And Nabonidus ruled for, I think it was like 17 years or something of that nature. There was at least 14 years where he never showed up in Babylon. This is the guy I mentioned who was something of an archaeologist. He would go out in the middle of nowhere, find some temple that had fallen into ruin, and rebuild it. And he spent years in the middle of the Arabian Desert, a little oasis south and east of Edom. And Edom is a pretty desolate place, going further out in the desert. And that's where he lived. Now, somebody has to be at home passing judgment. Somebody has to be at home reviewing the troops. Somebody at home has to be doing the king thing. And was typical for kings in ancient times. We see this in 1 and 2 Kings. We see this with ancient Israel and so forth, that you would have something called a co-regency. It becomes a family affair, mom and pop, or not, let me change that, dad and son operation, not mom and pop, although that sometimes happened in other places. But you had a co-regency. And so Nabonidus can be out traipsing across the desert, and he doesn't have to worry about things at home because his son is taking care of things. Now, in the Chronicle list of kings, Nabonidus is the king. He's the top dog. But he's not actually running the affairs. He'd rather be living out in the desert. So he leaves things to his son, who enjoys the city life and the authority and the pomp and all this other stuff. And so Belshazzar is Nabonidus' son. Now, to make things even more complicated, how many of you ever bothered looking up the family history of the Herods? Of the Herods?
A little bit.
Okay. You've got at least four Herods mentioned in the New Testament. Let me change that. I think there's five mentioned in the New Testament. Six. Because I'm running it through my mind. I may come up with it. Maybe even seven. We'll see. They're all related to each other. And to complicate matters, they may have different mothers. They married cousins and half-brothers and all kinds of weird things to make this convoluted family tree. And to find out who had the right to rule because he was the oldest and all this, it just gets very, very crazy. Especially when you got a bunch of them that have the same name. I mean, Herod. Okay? So you run into all kinds of difficulties when it comes to dynasties because they had a tendency to intermarry a lot. We see this in the European dynasties. They're all first and second and third cousins twice removed and all this other stuff. They're all related to one another. Which is frankly what gave us communism in Russia if you follow that back, because there was a congenital problem that caused, anyway, I don't want to even go there. All right. Co-regency. Let's ask a question. If you go to the book of 1 Kings, right at the beginning, Solomon has come to the throne. David has just passed away. Solomon's a young guy. And remember that there was an attempt to put Adonijah, who was the oldest surviving son of David, on the throne. But God, through revelation, had declared that Solomon was to be the guy, and through some quick action, Solomon got on the throne, even though a bunch of people already figured it was Adonijah. And so Adonijah's left out in the cold, and he's thinking, well, this is, you know, this stinks. And so he has an idea. He goes to Bathsheba. Pardon me for saying this, but I suspect that Bathsheba was blonde. He goes to Bathsheba, and he says, I got a favor to ask of you. Well, go ahead and ask. Ask your son Solomon, because I know he won't turn you down, because after all, you're his mom. By the way, she was not Adonijah's mom. As a matter of fact, they were probably close to the same age, Adonijah and Bathsheba. Not a whole lot of difference in the age between those. Ask Solomon for me that he give to me, who was it?
Abishag
to wife. I want Abishag. And Bathsheba, we'll come back to that. And Bathsheba says, okay, I'll ask him. And so she comes in before the king. By the way, this is going to come in this chapter, by the way. Who was queen under Solomon, at least at the beginning of his reign? Who was queen? Bathsheba was queen. In ancient Israel, in a lot of countries, the queen mother is queen. It isn't the wife of the king. It's the king's mother, or even his grandmother is the queen. And so She comes in, makes her request, and says, why are you doing this? Are you asking for asking the crown for him as well? Because Abishag, even though there were no physical relations between her and David, Abishag was technically David's concubine. And by Adonijah saying, can I have her? I'd like to marry this beautiful young lady. What Adonijah is doing is he's coming a backdoor claim to the throne. I'm not only the oldest son, but I'm also married to, and therefore I have a right to the throne. So, when you have an assassination, as you did here in Babylon, and then another assassination, and then another assassination, it was not at all unusual. You spared the ladies. You only bumped off the people you needed to bump off. You spared the ladies because you'd marry one of them. Because that gave you, if you weren't related to the king, that gave you a foot in the door and a legitimate bloodline claim. Nabonidus probably was married to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And therefore laying claim. And that way, Belshazzar is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Alright, through his mother. A lesser claim, but still a claim. Now, give you all that. We'll come back to that in a minute because that's going to come in to our arguments here in chapter 5. So anyway, the point is Belshazzar was never the king. He was always co-regent because his father outlived him. So in the lists of kings, he's never the top dog. And that's why his name wasn't on a lot of lists. And they finally, 100 years ago or so, not quite, found his name. And found out that the liberals were wrong. And there was this guy. Always believe this. All right? Archaeology is the Bible believer's friend. Now, the interpretations of archaeology are not always the Bible believer's friend. And they'll draw conclusions that are all off the wall. But the more they dig up, the more they do is find that, you know what, this was right in the first place. All right? Because people, generally speaking, there's exceptions, but generally speaking, people are not going to bury lies in the sand. You know, their city was destroyed, and when some guy comes in 3,000 years later and digs it up and finds this, that, the other thing, the pottery doesn't lie. All right? The inscriptions, generally speaking, don't lie, although some do. And we'll come back to that next week, because there are things where they lie. But we'll talk about why they did and so on. Because propaganda has been around a long time. All right, so that's who Belshazzar is. Belshazzar is the co-regent. He is the guy on the ground. He is the guy who is calling the shots, even though he is not the head honcho. He has all the authority of the head honcho because Dad likes to live out in the desert and hasn't shown up for 14 years. Okay, that's our scenario. Why is this important? It wouldn't be important except a lot of people say, this guy never existed. Come on, that's not the point of the chapter, but I'm telling you that people make a great deal out of anything they can, any wiggle room you can give a Bible denier. And I've mentioned time and time again, you start reading the commentaries, you say, why in the world are they spending so much time on this? Because it doesn't matter as far as the theme of the chapter. Because somebody thinks that this is important and this is going to give them an angle against the Bible. It doesn't, but we have to answer the objections so that we can come back and deal with the theme. Okay? There. So now you know who Belshazzar is. And why he's important. And if you have a study Bible, you might have a note on him that tells you in about 3 sentences what I just spent 15 minutes telling you. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords. Big crowd. And drank wine before the 1,000. So the feast came first, and then they drank. And it says there in verse 2, Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine. The word tasted is not, ooh, that's tasty, I like that. That's not the idea of the taste is that he is experiencing the wine. Which conveys a greater idea than just having it swirl around his tongue and compare it to the Chardonnay or this or whatever he's having. Instead, it is affecting him and he is somewhat inebriated. The wine is tasting him. And he commanded, it's amazing what people do while intoxicated they probably wouldn't do otherwise. You think of how many probably throughout history, millions of deaths have been, not talking about just drunk drivers and so on, but people making decisions that affect lots of other people. And because they're intoxicated. It's kind of interesting. With the new Calvinism that we discussed some time before, there is this preoccupation with the right, the privilege that I can drink wine and I can drink beer because the Bible does not, let me be careful on this, overtly prohibit it. So why am I drinking beer and why I'm drinking wine? Because I enjoy it. Yes, but whether therefore you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, all to the glory of God. Can I slam down my microbrew for the glory of God? Is this a benefit? No, what does it benefit? It makes me feel good about myself because I can drink this. It has nothing to do with the glory of God. It has to do with self-righteousness and self-pleasure and self-indulgence. And the new Calvinism jumps on this. They also advocate the smoking of cigars and pipes as well. Because, after all, we can. And that's a preoccupation they have, fixation they have. Which lets you know that also the new Calvinism is an academic affair and not a spiritual affair, because it really comes back to what I can do and what I want to indulge in and what I like. It has nothing to do with the glory of God. Even though they would scream bloody murder contrary to what I just told you. So this fellow's inebriated, and he's there with his kings and princes, his wives and his concubines, and he asks that the vessels that his father, grandfather, the word father can refer to father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and so on and so forth. It's a generic thing dealing with descent. That Nebuchadnezzar had brought out of the temple, which is in Jerusalem. So they're having this big party, this giant feast, and now we're dealing with the drunkenness that follows, and let's bring the vessels, the gold vessels that were taken from the temple in Jerusalem 60 years before, mind you. 60 years before. And we're going to toast the gods of gold and silver and brass and iron and wood and stone, it says there in verse 4. By the way, the room where this took place has been found. And I've got it mentioned here in the notes. It was, let's see, where was it? 55 by 157 feet or something like that. Big room. And now, say, did they see the handwriting on the wall? The handwriting on the wall would be way up there, and the existing walls are about down to here. So they have the floor plan, but they don't have much above that. But we do know that the walls were white because they were coated with lime. So the walls in this gigantic room, this giant banquet room, were white. And if you came into the room, which was much, 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 much wider than it was deep, there was a platform and a slight recess in the wall where the king would sit in this giant banquet hall. Okay. So envision this giant thing, and it's at night. And so you have, let's use our current term, you had candelabras stationed different places because they didn't have these things. And understand that when you read candlestick or candle in your Bible, it's not a candle. All right? Why do we know that? Because candles hadn't been invented yet. Candles? I thought candles had been around for thousands of years. No, candles have been around for maybe 1,000 years. That's it. Before that, they had something that worked just like a candle. You had the little slipper lamps. And, you know, Aladdin thing, you know. And you had a wick that went in there, and inside the lamp was usually olive oil. And you would light the wick, and you just keep adding oil. And you'd trim your wicks and so on, but that you had a permanent candle. And when you're dealing with a candelabra, you had a framework that had a bunch of these lamps on it. Works the same way as a modern candelabra, it's just not wax candles, instead it's these little lamps that have oil, but works the same. And you had a big one of these on the platform right near the king, so that the king could see what he was doing, and everybody could see the king. Assassinate the king, he's got to get close by. All right, so he's safe. He wants everybody to see him. It isn't that he becomes a target of a sniper, because you didn't really have snipers back in the day. Not the same idea that we had today. And he calls for these, and they're toasting the gods, the false gods. Now, in the middle of all this revelry, there's a room with 1,000 people in it. And think of the dimensions of the room. You can get 1,000 people in there, but it's going to be moderately tight. Not packed, but it'll be fairly tight. Verse 5. In the same hour came forth, I love this, came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Now, it's by the candlestick, so all the king has to do is do this, and it's right there. And I suspect that it was not probably something about this big. I think it was something, because the point is, everybody needs to see this. And the idea of, it says, that it came forth, is that the fingers came out of the wall. And it doesn't say there's a stylus or anything. It's possible the fingers were actually gouging into the plaster, but the intimation is that there was probably some sort of a tool in the hand. We don't know. Just says the fingers of man's hand came out and began to write. And the king saw. Now you can imagine all this revelry, all this laughter, maybe some music going on, and all of a sudden somebody screams and there's a pause, and then 1,000 people are very, 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 very quiet. And they're all staring. And then about the time that the hand is finished, it begins to be some whispers. And then it builds to a roar. And everybody is terrified. The music does not resume. But the revelries have stopped. It wrote on the plaster. I love the description here, verse 6. Then the king's countenance was changed. We've seen this several times. We see Nebuchadnezzar's face changed into a rage. But we see something very different with this fellow. His countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him. I think this is a great, great, great understatement. So that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against the other. I've shared this story, but it's the big time I saw this. When I was a youth pastor, we used to take an annual missions trip. We went to the Navajo Reservation. We went to New York City. We went to Boulder, Colorado one time to do stuff for Neighborhood Bible Time. We went to Red Cliff Bible Camp and worked in their kitchens for some time. So anyway, we did these missions trips. And one of the requirements was for those going on the trips is they had to raise half their money. Church would pay the other half, but they had to raise half their money. So these kids are having to come up with, well, about $700 apiece. And they had to work in VBS that summer, so they had to be they had to be teachers in VBS because they were going to be doing some of that when we went on the trip. And then also, when we got back, and believe it or not, this was the hardest part for a lot of these kids. They would have to, in the evening service, get up and each give a testimony about the trip. And we had some interesting things happen during those things. We had some people, they just get up there, and just as smooth as silk, just get up there and tell some things they did and just wonderful thing, and they enjoyed it and hope to be able to do it again, and thank you so much for encouraging us and helping us on the trip. And then they'd get down and, you know, give fist bumps or whatever. And then you get some other people. I can think of two that had real rough time. But anyway, let me give you this one. Kathy Aiken, who sits down here on Sunday morning, her eldest daughter, Andrea, who it's been a few years, but she shows up once in a while on Easter or something like that. Or did before she went to Africa. Very polished girl. Hard-working kid. Makes sure all of her ducks are in a row, always. This girl always has everything in line, everything lined up. Andrea just does not fumble the ball. She has a plan. Am I right? Okay. So she's up there with her 3x5 cards, all written out, all the things she's going to say. And she's all dressed up to the nines, you know, got a nice dress on and everything. I'm the only person sitting on the platform. I'm sitting here. The kids who went on the trip are all sitting down here in the front row. And I had talked to them in advance as far, you know, we're going to work the order here as far as who's doing what when. So you're not going to be fussing over each other. And then I said, all right, Andrea, come on up. And she comes up over here and she smiles and starts talking. And she's going through her cards and she is making eye contact as she goes through the things. And everything comes across just perfectly. I'm the only one that can see this because I'm up here. This poor girl's legs were doing this. Just if her legs were any closer together, you'd been able to hear it. I had two other kids that I had to get up, and they had it all written out, and I actually had to go up there and read their speeches for them because they just went, oh. They couldn't do it. His knees smote one against the other. This guy is terrified. He's the king. He's a leader of men. He's a leader of troops. He's up there on the platform for all to see. He's not afraid of being in front of people. He has experienced this his whole life. And the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers. Don't we see this fairly often? Go back to chapter 2 and chapter, you know, okay. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet. For scarlet, put the word, and you have this for newer translation probably, put in the word purple. What's the significance of purple? Oh, the purple. Lynn, would you hold up your jacket? About that color, actually a little lighter. About the color of a grape juice stain when it's fresh, before it browns out. Okay? It's a little redder than that. It's sort of in between. Actually, it's almost... Because you can go online and see this, because they've reproduced it. It's sort of a in-between of these. Okay? And how did they make this? I'm always curious as how did they discover it? What they would do is, in the eastern end of the Mediterranean, there is a snail called a dimurex. M-U-R-E-X, murex, or murex. Little snail about this big, saltwater snail. And what they would do is they would get pots about as big as those double doors and fill those with those snails and then top it off with water. Fresh water. And the snails would die. And they would let these dead, stinking snails marinate there in the hot Mediterranean sun for several weeks. And during the process, some chemicals would be created with some of the things that were in the snails. And they would pour off this stinking juice. How'd you like to work for that? That's almost better, as good as working in a rendering plant, okay? And they would pour off, and then they would take the stuff, and they went through several other processes, which were lost over time. And they would take fresh cloth and soak it in this nasty stuff. And when they were done soaking it, it came out this amazing purple that never turned brown, that never faded, that never changed. It was a set dye. It was remarkable. But boy, it was pricey. And if you were a noble, you might have a band of maybe 2 inches of this along the bottom of your garment. If you were the emperor of Rome, your whole robe was made out of this thing. Very, very, very pricey stuff. And during the Byzantine Empire, the ones that succeeded the Romans, the ability, because of war and a number of other things, the ability to make the dye passed off the scene. And yet the Byzantine emperors continued to wear the purple, by piecing together little bits and scraps wherever they could find them. And some of the garments, some of the pieces of cloth that were part of their very fancy robes may have been hundreds of years old. But they still wore the purple until the end of the Byzantine Empire in 1453. Purple. Royalty. Royalty for hundreds of years. And the king says, and only allowed, it isn't just if you could afford it, it was only allowed to be worn by certain people. And so he tells all of his wise men that I will clothe you in purple and have a chain of gold about your neck, and you shall be the third ruler of the kingdom. By the way, that concept of the third ruler there should have set people off that Belshazzar was the regent, because he didn't have the right to make him the second in command, because he was second in command. He could offer nothing higher than number three. So he makes this offer. All right, you wise guys. Come on in here, and this is what I'll do for you. And we have the same thing that we have in chapter 2. No one's able to do this. The bait is great. By the way, gold chains, depending on, and this was true for the Persians, we're not sure about the Babylonians, that there were certain types of gold chain and so on that could only be worn if they were given to you by the king. If you could afford it, that's fine. Do something else with your gold. You can't wear a particular type of gold chain around your neck, because that's an indication of the king's honor to you. It's like wearing the Congressional Medal of Honor. All right? And so he's offering him a great deal of prestige. Verse 8, they couldn't do it. And so now in verse 9, he's greatly troubled. I suspect that he has enough knowledge of the past, we're going to find out that he did, enough knowledge of the past that there's something exceedingly significant about this. After all, he did see the fingers himself. He's an eyewitness to this happening. And he is scared of judgment. What would also be an indicator besides the handwriting on the wall, which he can't interpret at this point? What would else be an indicator that possible judgment is looming? What is going on while this feast is going on? At the very moment, the city is surrounded by the Persians. Now, understand that the Babylonians on the inside were very, very confident. Walls are 87 feet thick. They're over 300 feet high. We've got ample water. We've got ample food. Let the Persians sit out there. Let them starve out there. We brought all the goodies inside. We have food, and they got to travel to get it. We'll see who outlasts whom. In the meantime, we're going to party. But they are there. And thus far, they have been unstoppable. This is the biggest fortress that they have come against, but they have been unstoppable. So the king is troubled. Now the queen, verse 10. The queen is probably Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. She's an older lady at this time. Nebuchadnezzar himself has been gone for over 17 years. And this lady is wasn't at the party. Maybe she is a little wiser than this. Maybe she learned the lessons because she was there when Nebuchadnezzar went through his madness and all these other things that we see in chapter 4. But for whatever reason, she wasn't there. But now she hears of what's going on because messengers are being sent from the king. Round up the wise men. And she's there in the palace and hears of what's going on almost certainly. And she comes in. She has a great deal of authority. She has access to the king. She's the queen mother. Pay attention to your mother. The queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the king, queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. There is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And this goes back to the same thing that we saw in chapter 3. This can be in singular or plural. If she recognizes the God of heaven, then she might be referring to in the singular as far as a plural of majesty. We don't know. We don't know. There's no possible way of knowing. If she happens to be in heaven when we get there, you can ask her. You're not going to know before then. And so this man was there. In the days of thy father, light and wisdom and understanding, like the wisdom of the gods, again, that could be singular or plural, were found in him whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, or grandfather as the case may be, thy king, I say, thy father made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, for as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding and interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts was found in this same Daniel. His name finally comes up. What's interesting is she doesn't call him Belteshazzar. She calls him Daniel, which lends a little bit of credibility to the possibility that she may have embraced the same faith that her husband seems to have at the end of his life. And maybe why she wasn't at the party, toasting the gods of stone and gold and wood and so forth. Now let Daniel be called and he will show the interpretation. I've got confidence in this guy. Now understand, Daniel's in his 80s at this point. It is possible that he was living in semi-retirement. We don't know. I mean, hey, he's in his 80s. Although I know certain people that work harder now in their 80s than they did when they were probably in their 60s. Isn't that right, Dave? Shh, you guys weren't supposed to know he was in his 80s. So Daniel's called in. Verse 13. And the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which is brought of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom my father, the king my father brought out of Jewry? Or out of Judah is the word there. I have heard of thee. He'd probably heard about him a long time before this. He needed to be reminded. He's living the life of the playboy king. I have heard of thee, that the spirit of of the gods, or God, is in thee, that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men of the astrologers have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation. I have heard of thee, that you can, you're the last ditch, and you can do it. And if you do this, I will clothe you with purple, put a chain of gold about your neck, and make you the third ruler in the kingdom. I'm making you the same offer I made everybody else. And they couldn't do it. So here's the offer. Tell me what it says and what it means. Daniel starts up in verse 17. Daniel had, you go back, he had the utmost respect for Nebuchadnezzar. He doesn't seem to show, I mean, he's not flippant, but he's not going to show the same respect to Belshazzar. Daniel answered and said unto the king, let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards to another. Why, by the way, he will at the end receive them. Why did he say this? Why did Daniel say that? I don't want your gifts. Give them to somebody else. But I'll still answer your question. Okay, but he's going to receive them. Now, grant he doesn't need them. And it's a thing of honor, prestige, which in this time and culture comes in handy for being able to influence, which is what Daniel wants. He wants influence. Not for himself, but for the God he represents. But why does he initially decline? There's some reasoning here. One is, I don't want this. Number two, why do I need this? You're toast tonight. All right? The Persians are going to be in here tonight. I don't need this. Now, we find out later that it was actually a pretty bloodless coup sort of situation. And that Daniel actually just rolls into the next administration. Because, you know, he's a paper jockey. Par excellence, but he's a paper jockey. Why does he decline? If the king doesn't like you, if the king makes a decree against you, or he says off with his head, do you have any recourse? None. You're dealing with an absolute monarch. Daniel, I think, starts this out to let the king know that whatever you're offering is not going to influence what I'm about to tell you. I'm not going to paint this a rosier picture than it is. You're going to get it the way it is. I don't want your gifts. I'm still going to tell you what it says, but you're going to get it exactly the way it's way it is. I'm not backpedaling on this. I'm not going to make it easier. You're going to get it exactly the way it is because I'm not getting rewarded for this. And then he politely chastises the king. Verse 18. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, grandfather, a kingdom and majesty and honor and glory. And for the majesty that he gave him, all peoples and nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would he slew, whom he would he kept alive, whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his throne from him. And that's the madness that we saw last week in chapter 4. Put him out on the North 40 until his head came back. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart made like the heart of beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses, and they fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and he appointeth it over it whomsoever he will. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thy heart, though thou knew all this. There was nothing that Daniel just told him that he didn't already know. You knew why your grandfather endured this. You knew exactly why this was the case because Nebuchadnezzar made a decree for all to hear and know there in chapter 4. You knew this backwards and forward, and not only that, you probably went out there and saw Grandpa grazing. You know this, and you know why. And what have you just done? You have mocked the God of heaven and toasted gods that are not with the articles that were used for the worship of the God of heaven. Even though you knew what happened to your grandfather and why. And Daniel is saying, Belshazzar, you're a fool. You're a fool. You didn't learn. Verse 23. But thou liftest up thyself against the Lord of heaven. And they have brought the vessels of his house before thee. And thou and thy lords and thy wives and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold and brass and iron, wood and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. Say, he's pulling no punches, is he? Before a heathen. Before a polytheistic heathen. Who is an absolute monarch. Keep your gifts. I'll tell you what you need to hear. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, thou hast not glorified. Every breath that anybody has ever drawn is the gift of God. Every heartbeat is the gift of God. And the God who keeps you alive and has sustained you, you have mocked and shaken your little tiny fist at. Even though you knew what this God did in regard to your grandfather. And the lesson that your grandfather, by the grace of that God, learned. So, here's the message sent by the God that you have defied. The God that you have mocked. This was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the writing that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Now, don't want to get into a long discussion on why they weren't able to read it. It's possible it was written sideways or up and down instead of left to right. Right to left, as was typical for the language of the day. We don't know. Also understand that they didn't use vowels as we did. It's possible you had in a giant square the letters lined out and it would be impossible to read them. It's like a find-a-word puzzle with no vowels. Okay, we don't know. All we know is that the wise guys weren't able to figure it out, and Daniel comes in by revelation and tells them exactly what it says, and it comes about exactly as he said. Here's the interpretation of the thing. Mene. Mene means numbered or counted or weighed. Or, excuse me, counted. Tekel. Thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez. Perez is singular for upharsin. The word you is the word and. And far sin. Far sin is plural for Perez. Same letters that would be used for the word Persian. And in the writing on the wall, indistinguishable. The kingdom is divided or broken and given to the Medes and the Persians. Now, key thing there, Medes come before Persians. You will see that pretty consistently in Daniel. I will explain why next week. Because you get to Esther, and Persians come before Medes, and there's a reason for that too. So the king gets the news. Is he enraged? Does he throw his goblet at Daniel? Ask him to be thrown into the den of lions? Does he banish him, throw him off the rampart down into the waiting Persian armies? No, he keeps his word. Verse 29. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with the purple, and put a gold chain around his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. I got the message. What's interesting is everything indicates that he accepted the message. There's no indication of repentance. But he heard it. It was almost like he shrugs his shoulders and follows through on his promise, and who knows, maybe the party kept going. We don't know. But we do know this. In that night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was slain. The Greek historians say that when the Persian soldiers came in, he raised a dagger and they actually were able to capture him alive, and he died a few days later under other circumstances. Or shortly thereafter under different circumstances. And Darius the Median, verse 31 is verse 1 of chapter 6 in the Hebrew. Or as this case may be in the Aramaic. Darius the Median took the kingdom being about 62 years old. We will spend a fair amount of time dealing with this guy next time. Because if you think Belshazzar has created a huge uproar, Darius the Mede has created an even bigger one. He's almost a passing guy. He's mentioned here in chapter 6, but he's just the guy there. They don't make this, he's not anything super important as far as history is concerned or anything else. But we're going to discuss who he is, and we actually have two primary options, and I'll let you know which one I think is better. But this is going to bring us back to Herodotus and Xenophon and the irreconcilable between the two and why I will favor Xenophon over Herodotus. All right. Any questions or anything on what we've seen here in chapter 5? Yes, Tom.
Yes, what I was going to ask you. Now, when Belshazzar died, does that mean that was the end of the Babylon Empire?
Yes.
It was?
Yes. What happened was... Okay. Are you ready for the map? Persian Gulf. Tigris and Euphrates. Babylon. Persia. Babylon. And then over here you've got the Mediterranean coast. It's not quite to scale, but you get the idea. And then we have, Egypt down over here. Okay. Now, the Persians conquered all that. And then they moved over here and they conquered all that. They conquered all of what is now Turkey except for the extreme west end where the Greeks were. They'll get to that. And they come down here and they conquer some of this turf. Okay? Now, if you go further this way, you start getting into Pakistan and some other areas, and you can go there as far as you want to. Alexander the Great went that way. But the Persians wanted to deal with two other things. They wanted to deal with the big guys. Because if you don't deal with the big guys that are close to home, you can go east as far as you want to and build a gigantic empire, but if you've got strong guys that are a feasible threat that are close to home, it's a danger. Let's deal with the guys close to home first. Now, when we get to the bear that has three ribs in his mouth, okay, later on in the book of Daniel, okay, the three ribs are, we got rib here, that'd be the Lydian Empire. We have rib down here, which is Egypt, and we have rib here, which is Babylon. Those are the three guys the Persians had to take out before they could really make any serious conquest beyond that. Babylon was the one that had to be taken out first. Number one, it's closest. Number one, and number two, it was the strongest. And so the Persians took the northern swath of Babylon's empire. And then they worked down here through what is now the northern half of Iraq. And then they got to Babylon. And once they took Babylon, all the other cities sort of cascaded and fell into place. But they had to do this. And when they did this, they didn't... I got a little time. How did the Persians conquer the city? I told you about how big the walls were. It's in your notes. You got walls over 300 feet high, what, 87 feet thick or something like that. And you got a circumference of the city of over 55 miles. The Euphrates flowed under the walls, great big huge bronze columns holding up the wall. But there was these giant columns. The river flowed underneath, through town, and out the same way.
Well, a river runs through it.
Yes. So what did they do? And they got walls along it. Okay, it's engineered, so you can't, and it's fairly deep. They got it chopped deep for a canal type situation. What the Persians did is they dug a giant canal a couple miles away and rerouted the river. And then when they filled it in, you know, all right, everybody get their shovels, and they blocked off the river, and it starts flowing through the new channel they've dug. And pretty soon this all sinks down into the sand. and you got no more river running through. Instead, you've got a road going right underneath the wall and coming right into town. And we'll do it in the middle of the night when no one's paying attention. And the Persian armies walked in, and they dealt with the soldiers that initially attacked them, marched into the palace. There's the king. We got the king. We captured the king. Checkmate. It's over. We have it all. And you didn't have to kill tens of thousands of people. We bumped off a few dozen, maybe a few hundred, and we got it. And that's what they did. And so when they were all done, Babylon was still intact. The buildings were intact. You woke up the next day, and probably a lot of people in town didn't know what had happened. Things are still going on as normal. The markets are open. Everything's going, oh, wait a minute, the gates are open. Why is that? Are the Persians gone? No, they're here. But there was no major engagement. They slipped in and took it. And so that's how they did, and that's why Babylon was not destroyed. It fell into decay, and it was going to be another over 1,000 years before Babylon went away, as far as an inhabited place. But the reason it went away eventually is because the Euphrates was over there instead of here. Yeah, they probably could have, but you had to have enough manpower to do it, enough, you know. Alexander the Great wanted to do it. He died in Babylon. He wanted to remake Babylon into its past glory. He was going to make that his capital, and he died. But that was his goal. All right, anything else? Did that answer your question? Okay, anything else? All right. Father, thank you. Lord, you are indeed in charge of the affairs of men. And Father, those who think that they are invincible will find themselves very, very, very weak in the eyes of God. And Father, when you call their time, it's over. Father, you've done this time and time again in world history, that some of the most powerful, at the peak of their power, fall away. Father, thank you that your purposes will come to pass. And Father, as we look at empires and so on in the next several weeks, Father, help us to recognize that you are in charge of the affairs of men. And Father, there will come a kingdom that will never be succeeded by any human kingdom. You will rule and reign forever. Father, thank you for this. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.